Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. More attacks and threats to power stations are being investigated after tens of thousands lost power in North Carolina when two substations were damaged by gunfire. Investigators have called the attack deliberate, and now the FBI is looking into reports of gunfire yesterday near a substation in South Carolina. Power stations were also targeted in Oregon and Washington last month. Federal regulators set new rules to better protect critical infrastructure nearly a decade ago after a PG&E substation in California in San Jose was attacked. We look at why our power grid is still vulnerable. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Power is being restored to more than 40,000 people in North Carolina who've been without electricity since Saturday when two substations were attacked by gunfire. Residents shivered in the dark, some unable to use vital medical equipment, as schools and businesses closed and traffic lights went out. Investigators are taking a hard look at whether domestic extremist groups might be behind the attacks on the power grid. We look at just how vulnerable our critical energy infrastructure is to this, nationally and here in California. Joining me, John Wellinghoff, former chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. He led the agency when a California substation was attacked in 2013. Now he's the head of Grid Policy Consulting. Welcome to Forum, John Wellinghoff.
Thank you, Susan, for having me.
Glad to have you here. And Juliet Kayyem is with us, CNN national security analyst and former Department of Homeland Security under President Obama. Juliet Kayyem, also really glad to have you as well.
Thank you for having me.
So the motive for the power station attack in North Carolina, it's still unknown. No one's been caught, but investigators have called it intentional and targeted. Why can they say that, at least?
Well, Susan, if I can start off on that.
And actually, John, it is Mina. Susan is our wonderful producer, though.
Excuse me.
So I can understand the confusion.
Thank you, Mina. I apologize, please. I've only had 15 interviews in the last 3 days on this issue.
So completely understand. Yeah.
trying to keep the people straight here, Mina.
Sure.
But from what I can see, I think this was purposeful and targeted in the sense that the 40,000 people were on a radial line that had a particular substation that was a single point of failure. So somebody must have known that and figured that out to be able to hit that particular substation, which was the West End substation in Moore County, North Carolina, to be able to produce the effect and impact that they did produce.
Huh. So do you think that this could be the work of insiders, John? Meaning, how would you know that?
Well, unfortunately, it's too easy to know. The grid infrastructure is on the internet. There's an open source site that anybody can go to find any transmission line, any substation, the voltages, the number of transformers. It's all available, in fact, not only for the United States, but for every country in the world, with the exception of China. You can go find Venezuela, you can find Australia, you can find Belgium and the U.S., and you can trace out the lines as to where they go and who they serve.
Juliet, I understand that investigators are looking at several possible motives, yeah. But certainly one that's been brought up a lot is that you can potentially connect this to extremist beliefs. Why are extremist or hate groups or anti-government groups being brought up in the context of this attack in North Carolina?
Well, good morning there, and good afternoon here on the East Coast. And it's great to be here with John as well, whose commentary I have been following about the vulnerabilities of all infrastructure, not just energy grids. So look, the pools of possibilities are not infinite. When this started, you could have put them into three pools. One would be some sort of foreign enemy that was testing our system, so would do a smaller substation, unlikely in this case in particular, because this was a physical attack, not a cyber attack. The second would be someone with a grudge to Duke Energy or the company, so an insider in that sense, someone who is motivated to just bring the company down. And then the third would be some sort of animus motivation. And the reason why your focus on that now is not only for the reasons John said, that this clearly was well planned out. These aren't just drive-by shootings. You'd have to know what you're shooting at and its impact. But because these radical groups, right-wing, have told us that they want to do this. I mean, they have had manifestos as early as 2020 that this is their intention. There have been incidents in the United States in the past. They don't get much play because a lot of times they're not successful. Where a right-wing extremist or other groups, militia-type groups, go after the grid. They want to do it for two reasons. One is disruption. It's just the philosophy of disruption. If I can prove that I can do it, I can show America's vulnerabilities. The other is really much more nefarious, and that is that they believe, at least in their literature, and when they promote going after critical infrastructure and energy grids, they believe that darkness will bring about violence, civil war, race war, whatever it is they want. And so it's the darkness that they actually, the dysfunction and the darkness that they actually have sort of animated around. And so any investigator is going to begin with that theory. And it seems to be honestly where they're heading.
Really? What makes you say where they're heading? Have you heard anything about
the report so far? I mean, you know, obviously they're talking about intentionality. They have not closed off domestic terrorism. And from an investigator's perspective, you want to turn that off quickly, because that's just a whole level of investigation that is troublesome and worrisome for a community. So if you knew, for example, that it was an insider threat, or if you were leaning that way, you shut it down. We see police departments doing it all the time. If there's, for example, a shooting, they'll say there's no racial animus or whatever. And then also, as I said, is this has been a steady drumbeat of attempts by these militias and right-wing groups for some time. And this is wildly successful, maybe more successful than they intended, who knows, but this has been wildly successful in terms of its impact and its consequences for that community. So I would be, we're not in the guessing game, but just based on motive, means, where they hit, you would be starting with a domestic, ideologically based organization group. A group may be too strong. You know, it could be just a couple guys.
Right. But as you're saying, they also have not closed off domestic terrorism. So that is interesting. In terms of animus, investigators, they have no evidence connecting the attack to a drag event in the same county, but they are considering it. Why? Is it because the timing of it?
There were two reasons why in this case, they could both be coincidences. So the LGBTQ community, much like the Jewish community, is now a sort of dominant focal point for these organizations. And in the case of the LGBTQ community, it does have sort of a political resonance with bans on trans kids or sports and trans children. There's a series of targets against a hospital where I am in Boston, which is one of the only hospitals that gives both mental and physical assistance to trans youth. So the trans LGBTQ issue for them is one that they've gotten a lot of traction on. And it just happens to be that there was at the same time an event supporting Pride and supporting the LGBTQ community. So you're just going to look at that sort of that nexus and in terms of animation. There was a second piece. Once again, we're just going to go by what law enforcement tells us. They that leader of this organization, the anti-LGBTQ organization, sort of tried to claim credit in a weird way by saying she knows why this happened. But that might be too cute. And so you're not going to base your investigation on what she claims she was responsible for. But I would guess they have interviewed her and she just wanted to get credit. So that is why you've heard this narrative out there in the last week. Oh, it's almost been a week. Yeah.
We're talking about the attack on two North Carolina electrical substations with Juliette Kayyem, a former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under President Barack Obama, and the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. John Wellinghoff is with us, former chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, also under President Obama, and now CEO of Grid Policy Consulting. And you, our listeners, are invited to join the conversation. What are your questions about what happened in North Carolina? What do you want to know about the security of our power grid in California or nationally? 866-733-6786 is the number. You can post your questions on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. You can email forum at kqed.org. John, really quick before the break, I am just curious if you could explain a little bit about how so much damage can be caused by taking out transformers. What exactly is happening here?
Well, thank you, Mina. Basically, the transformer is the node in the system that either steps up or steps down power to make it continue along its route to serve people. So if you don't have the transformers, that power can't continue within the network. And there are, you know, certain critical ones within the system that if you hit those critical ones, it can cause the system to go out of frequency. And as a out of frequency event, it can cascade. We had an example of a cascading outage, and that was in 2003. We all remember, you know, what happened to the East Coast, because basically there was a storm in the Midwest, and there was a tree that got into a power line that touched into a power line, and that cascaded into an outage all the way through to New York and New Jersey. And that outage, I think, continued on for approximately 3 days. So these outages can cascade if you hit the critical areas or critical nodes that keep the power in frequency.
And as important as they are, they're quite exposed, it sounds like.
Well, they were. Some standards have been put in place, and we can talk about that in some detail after the break. But many of these substations, like the one in North Carolina, are only surrounded with a chain link fence and may have minimal security, may have some cameras or some, you know, motion sensing lights or, you know, other things to deter people. But to the extent that people can actually see into them and shoot through the fence and target specific critical pieces, including the transformers in those substations, they're vulnerable.
Well, we will talk more about this, as you say, after the break. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Here's what we're talking about tomorrow. Anyone can do karaoke, even if you can't sing. We'll tell you why. And if you want to tell us what you like to belt out at karaoke clubs and family gatherings, our voicemail line is 415-553-3300. Today, we're talking about the deliberate attack on two North Carolina electrical substations that left more than 40,000 people without power this week, and what it says about the vulnerability of our critical infrastructure, both here in California and nationally. And we want to hear from you. What are your questions about what happened in North Carolina, or questions about the security or structure of our power grid? We're talking with John Wellinghaw, former chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and also Juliette Kayyem, former assistant secretary for Homeland Security. And you can join the conversation at 866-733-6786 by emailing forum at kqed.org or finding us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. So, John, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that a lot of these substations with important equipment are sort of surrounded by chain link fences and so on. I've heard you say that this attack could have been averted with relatively simple things, even sandbags. Can you talk about why you say that there is a relatively, you know, not super sophisticated or expensive way to try to avert these things?
Well, I mean, basically all you have to do is stop a projectile from going into one of the critical pieces of that infrastructure, a transformer, for example. If you put up sandbags around the transformer, it's going to stop the projectile. What they did PG&E did in San Jose with the Metcalf substation that was attacked in 2013 is they put up a block wall around that substation. It had a chain link fence and they put up a block wall. And supposedly utilities are now required to determine what parts of their infrastructure is critical, and they're supposed to develop a plan to protect what they designate as critical. That's under a critical infrastructure protection standard that was approved by FERC back in 2015 after the Metcalf incident in 2013.
You say is supposed to be doing these things. Is it because it's not happening at the scale that you would like to see?
Well, first of all, let me take you back to 2013, the Metcalf incident. There was south of San Jose, a substation there where 17 transformers were shot out of 21 in the facility. And it was, you know, widely reported and discussed in the media, just like the North Carolina incident. And I took a team down there to investigate that particular incident. By the way, the FBI has caught nobody with respect to that incident. They don't know who was involved. They have no idea to this day. But because of all the media attention and because of my calling for, at the time, something to be done, and actually I was leaving FERC at the time, so I couldn't follow up on it. My successors actually put in place a standard, SIP 01401, that is to require utilities to, as I say, designate what they believe to be critical and to develop a plan for protecting it and submit that plan to FERC. However, that standard was actually written by the industry. And it wasn't written by FERC. It was written by the industry. It's not a prescriptive standard. It doesn't say you have to put up a block wall, you have to put up barriers to stop a projectile. It says none of that. It's very vague. It basically says you have to develop a plan, and the plan has to protect the infrastructure that you, as the utility, designate as critical. So, you know, in North Carolina, Duke may have not have designated this particular substation as critical, and they may have no plan for it to protect it because they didn't need to. But again, they wrote the standards. The industry wrote the standards, not FERC. And that's a result of Congress's enactment in 2005 of the Energy Policy Act, which gave FERC reliability responsibility, but didn't give them responsibility to actually write the reliability rules. It under a compromise in that bill, allowed the industry to actually write the rules. FERC, in fact, adopts those rules. It oversees them and it enforces them, but it's the industry that actually writes them.
Interesting. So, well, Juliette Kayyem, whether or not we will see more of these kinds of attacks, given what sounds like oversight and efforts made by, in a lot of cases, these are private companies who own these substations and so on, whether or not they will step up and do more. I guess what I'm curious about is how you see the impact of them. Yeah. You talked about how these groups want to, if it is in fact hate groups that are taking out these stations, want to plunge the U.S. in darkness and sow chaos and so on and warring. But whether or not that is even achieved, one thing that's been really clear with the North Carolina incident is that it really has a major effect on people's lives.
Yeah. No, these are attacks against civilians. I mean, ultimately, we can call it critical infrastructure. But if we were in a wartime, if we were in war with another country, and they went after the energy grid and impacted parents' ability to get their kids to school, you wouldn't sort of say, oh, this is an attack on critical infrastructure. It is. These are meaningful attacks because of our connectivity, because how we live, and we've come to rely on them, so that when they're taken away, here in the United States, we don't have a lot of redundancies. We're not, there's not a lot of give in the systems. These are what we call in the security field as well, the single points of failure. And the challenge is right now, the way our infrastructure is built there's multiple risks. We say snipers, hackers, and hurricanes, right? This is what you worry about. And you worry about what we saw in California, North Carolina, and there have been other cases of the drive-by shootings trying to shoot them. The use of scissors can go very far, surprisingly. And we saw that in California. Hackers, we've spent a lot of time on cybersecurity of our infrastructure, but that is vulnerable, as we saw in Colonial Pipeline just over a year ago, a ransomware attack against a company no one had ever heard of before. It happens to be a company that distributes not 50%, but not far from 50% of pipeline maintenance on the East Coast. It cannot get out of this hack of this ransomware. Its only option is to turn the system completely off. It is off for close to a week. That's not a very sophisticated response planning, but that's because of the connectivity between cyber and physical. And then, of course, climate change, which people are experiencing in California every single day. The infrastructure cannot withstand the dryness, the wind, the fires, the water, right? And these are the challenges for us, one of them being motivated by malintent, but all of them having the same consequences. In Homeland Security, there is a 16 sector division of critical infrastructure. That just means that it's a way to try to organize what we view as primary in terms of civilian living, right? So it's transportation, emergency services, chemical facilities, dams and water, energy, and the energy sector is one of them. And there are, as John was saying, regulations, but they are essentially floors. They get us somewhere. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that people like me who think about the Homeland Security side is that we really don't talk in terms of safe anymore. There's no way you could get a system and a nation like ours with its connectivity and its governance systems with different states and everything. There's no way safe is not your goal. Your goal is safer. Are there ways in which we can minimize the potential that this thing is vulnerable, whether it is arrest, disrupting these efforts, sandbags, as John was saying, lighting and surveillance cameras, elevating generators so that they don't get drowned out, all the things that you see being done in light of any threat. And then what's our capability of getting this stuff back up and running after and to make communities safer? Those are that's your standard of success is just safer. And there's a lot we can do, but the idea that we can make this stuff invulnerable, you wouldn't want to live in that society, right? We wouldn't move if that were the case.
Yeah. Well, Steve writes, can your guests relate the attack in North Carolina to a similar attack some years ago on a substation in Santa Clara County? And of course, we just did that. And Juliet, you were talking about things that we can do. And John, you were talking about things that FERC has done, though, a floor, as you say, Juliet. I actually want to bring into the conversation KQED editor and reporter Dan Brecky, who has looked more closely at what California has done since 2013, since that attack in Santa Clara County. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mina.
So what steps has CPUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, taken to address the risk of attacks on energy infrastructure here?
Well, so after Metcalf, there was legislation from Assemblymember, or State Senator, rather, Jerry Hill, down on the peninsula, for the CPUC to actually get involved in this in a much more aggressive way. And so the CPUC undertook what's called rulemaking procedures. They part one was more or less a study and initial action phase, and then there is a second rulemaking to enact some of the findings from the first stage. And what came out of that is that all utilities, all electrical utilities in California have to come up with a physical security plan that outlines what the vulnerabilities are and what steps are going to be taken to address those vulnerabilities, with the CPUC Safety and Enforcement Division sort of keeping watch on what's going on. Now, it's, you know, I take John's point about, you know, there's a gap between what we're told is being done often and what actually happens. You know, PG&E infrastructure, for instance, has proven quite problematic during the current siege of wildfires we've seen. And what we do know from public-facing documents is that PG&E has, you know, they say they've spent already $300 million in the last 10 years on improving security at some of their vulnerable facilities, and that they have a process in place. Now, we don't know the details. I mean, there is, on the federal level, there's something called critical infrastructure, critical electrical infrastructure information, which is kind of a curtain that's drawn across, you know, what we can know about any sensitive topic having to do with power facilities. This was true at Oroville Dam, for instance, after the spillway failure. We don't really know a lot of the details about what happened there because of this critical electrical infrastructure information. So in the same way, the utilities have convinced the state to let them not really, you know, tell us specifics. But, you know, in the final security report for PG&E, for instance, they say that they've identified many facilities that can be upgraded. The upgrades, you know, range in cost and time involved from a year and maybe $5,000 up to multi-million dollar projects that could take as much as 8 years. So that's kind of where things stand now.
Well, do we know how frequently these attacks are occurring on substations? Because I know that KQED has reported on some recent ones in Butte and Kern County.
There appears to be a spike in vandalism and direct attacks on substations and other power facilities in California over the last couple of years. Now, I say, so, you know, in raw numbers, the state, well, let me back up. There is a requirement for utilities to report to the U.S. Department of Energy, you know, significant electrical incidents. And it could be, generally speaking, the most common are severe weather caused power outages. But there has been an increase in California in these reports of vandalism and direct attacks over the last decade, especially. In 2013, for instance, there were six of these incidents recorded in California, three the following year. This year, up through August 31st, there have been 23 incidents, 17 vandalism and five direct attacks. And as you mentioned, we have reported on this. You know, my editor, Ted Goldberg, watches the state hazardous materials spill database on an almost daily basis. And this is where two of these attacks came to light, because hazardous materials were spilled during the course of these incidents. So one, it was down in Kern County on July 3rd, where somebody in a similar attack to what happened at Metcalf, although on a much smaller scale, went out and shot up a substation and put out power to about 1,000 people for several hours, or 1,000 customers. And then there was an incident up in Butte County in September where somebody drove along a rural road south of Chico and shot up a series of transformers, I think 7 transformers. There's no record of power being out. And I will say about these incidents that most of them are minor. No power goes out, you know, nobody's inconvenienced by them. And so it doesn't come to wider notice. But it is somewhat striking that so many of these have been recorded and that there are more of them. And just one caveat I'll add, and thanks for allowing me to dominate the floor here, is I haven't dug into this enough to know whether the increase in incidents is because there's better reporting now, better required reporting, or whether there's more mischief being done, or both.
Yeah. Well, Dan, if people want information on these sort of attacks, vandalism, or actual gunfire and so on California substations, before I let you go, tell us, where can they go?
Well, now you're going to expose me for not having done all my homework. I have the Department of Energy actually has a page where these reports are available, and I will tweet out to KQED Forum and on my own Twitter account at Dan Brecky what the address for those reports are.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Always good to have you on.
You're welcome.
Dan Brecky, editor and reporter at KQED News. Juliet, Dan described. Sorry, go ahead, John. You had a comment?
I was just going to break in. Yeah. Dan, you can send out that link, but if people just want to look up on the internet, OE 417, that's the DOE report number. 417 is the report number for those incidents, and it provides you a list of them. They do them by year, and it's sort of a spreadsheet list of line items of reported incidents by the utilities. Every utility has to report any outage to DOE.
Again, John Wellinghoff is former chair of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and now CEO, founder of Grid Policy Consulting. And he was head of FERC when the PGE Metcalf Power Station near San Jose was attacked, which we just talked about, and then left shortly after. Juliet Kayyem is former Assistant Secretary for Homeland Security under President Obama and the faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. You probably know Juliet from CNN as well as an analyst there. Juliet also has a recent book, The Devil Never Sleeps, Learning to Live in an Age of Disasters. And we just heard from Dan Brecky, editor and reporter for KQED. We're coming up on a break, and we've got lots of questions and calls. I see them, and we will get to them right afterward. But feel free to ask what happened in North Carolina if there are things that you are wondering about or about the structure or security of our power grid and how you're reacting to this. Email forum at kqed.org. Find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at KQED Forum. 866-733-6786 is our number. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees, who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the security of our power grid here in California and nationally in the wake of an attack on substations in North Carolina. And this listener tweets, "This is one of the most worrying secrets that's been hiding out in the open for decades. Electrical distribution and transmission have always been highly vulnerable to sabotage by people with a modicum of knowledge and readily available rifles." Let me go to caller Barbara in Sunnyvale. Barbara, thanks for waiting. You're on. Barbara, are you there? Let me see if we can get Barbara back. Meantime, let me go to Alex in Menlo Park. Hi, Alex. You're on.
Yes. Good morning. I work for a large consulting firm, one of the big four consulting firms, and I've worked on a lot of physical security, cybersecurity programs with energy companies, the likes of Dukes and PG&E. And one of the observations, and I'm not sure if any of your guests will agree, is that a lot of emphasis is put on access to the systems, but not on the perimeter security and the physical security itself. And this has been my observation, when I've done assessments for most of those programs. I've worked on the NERC. I think some of the guests would know what that NERC SIP program is. And I'll take my, I just wanted to make that comment, see if your guests would agree or disagree.
Well, John, I imagine you would, right?
Well, yes. I would agree. And as the gentleman referred to, there is not only a FERC approved, and it is a NERC standard, he's correct, which is the National Electrical Reliability Corporation, which is a private nonprofit entity composed of the utility industry that writes these regulations that I mentioned before. There is a NERC standard approved by FERC for cybersecurity, and it does have certain physical access requirement restrictions in it as well. And I'm sure that Juliet can speak to it also. But I think the gentleman is right. I think the physical aspect, not only physical security of infrastructure, but also physical security of cyber assets, sometimes is not thought about or emphasized as much as it should be.
Yeah, well, this listener writes, what about cameras at the site tracking vehicles that are in the area? Was this in place at the recent site? How costly would this be to implement at every site? John, you mentioned this, but in terms of just how much these are implemented, how effective they would be,
interesting, there were cameras at the Medcalf site in San Jose. Didn't do PG&E or anybody else a lot of good. We saw the video afterwards, which we could see the shadowy figures and the muzzle flash, and we could see them, signaling with their flashlights to each other to start firing and to stop firing. So the cameras only work if somebody's looking at the cameras or monitoring them, or they have some AI that can determine, that something is happening in the camera that needs to be addressed immediately.
Well, Karen asks, I want to know what kind of weapons they were shooting to do all that damage. John or Juliet? The weaponry?
I don't think we know yet.
They recovered casings, but they still haven't quite.
They have casings. So from the casings, they should know, but it hasn't been reported on North Carolina. But I heard this morning, again, it's only from a reporter. I don't know that it's correct, that the weapons that they used in North Carolina were actually of a higher caliber than was used in San Jose. And the caliber in San Jose was quite interesting, because the caliber was apparently specifically selected to do, targeted damage to the cooling fins, which were thinner metal, than to actually penetrate the cases of the transformers. The ammunition they used in San Jose was not sufficiently powerful enough to actually go through the 5/8 inch metal cases of the transformer, but did penetrate the cooling fins.
Mm-hmm. Well, I see that Barbara is back. Hi, Barbara, you're on.
Hi. Yeah. So my comment is just exactly what he was talking about. The specific detail being shared. Oh, this wasn't, strong enough ammunition to penetrate the specific width of the of the casing or whatever. And I just wonder sometimes the detail that we share out there, is it worth it for the public to know all this information where it might fall on, you know, nefarious ears? And, you know, not everybody, you know, are very good readers, and they may not be able to, well, maybe they have one person in their group that is a good, you know, internet access person. But
yeah. Well, Barbara, I think you raise an interesting point. Could we be planting seeds by giving it media coverage, Juliet? Are you worried about
that? I mean, so part of the media coverage, I appreciate the point, and there's certainly a lot of details we don't know, and I suspect that that's true, that there's just, I'm much more comfortable, even though I spend a lot of time with and on media, I'm a lot more comfortable that there are details we don't know, including what did they capture from other videos? What have they already collected? All of that's being done behind the scenes. But remember, part of this, of the distribution, or part of the purpose for the dissemination of the information, is we don't have the guys yet. Assuming that they're guys. And, and so disseminating this information about what we think, whether it's the casings, what kind of weaponry, when they were there, where they might have been in relation to the power grids. People know things that they don't know that they know. In other words, they, I happened to see a car there at that time. So part of this is more choreographed than careless. Sometimes I get it. Sometimes things are quite careless. I'm much more comfortable thinking that a lot of this is a little bit like, we got to get these people, and there's others who may know or have details that that we want to get out there. As for, you know, do we, I sort of feel like the cat is out of the bag. Someone who is a bad actor simply has to go outside. I'm at home today in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm looking outside. I mean, you could do a lot of damage on Mass Avenue here. I mean, in some ways, the vulnerability of this is transparent. And what we need to focus on, since we can't make it totally invulnerable, is in fact the motivations, or that either let this stuff fester, in other words, groups organize around critical infrastructure, or or criminal prosecution. It is very important, I hope, that we find these people. I think the failure to find the attackers in 2013 in California I don't want to say it left a door open, but I think you don't want people to think that there's no consequences for this behavior. And that's how we use the criminal justice system, is there are consequences whether you intend to create this kind of havoc or not.
Yeah, well, my colleague Dan before the break was characterizing this increase that we're seeing in California as a bit of a spike. I'm wondering if you are seeing that nationally, Juliet, because I'm remembering just this past February, I think the DOJ foiled the plot, right, of three white supremacists. They were part of a white supremacist group who conspired to damage power infrastructure in Ohio.
Right. So we're now starting to hear of these arrests that had happened that we ignored because nothing bad had happened. As the reporter was saying, you know, some of these happen and there's no consequences just because the system can withstand it. Mm-hmm. So we have the original 2013, or not the original, it's not the original. All of this stuff has been vulnerable. And remember, this is just one type of critical infrastructure. So you have 2013 in California, you have Ohio this year, which is the one you just described, where it was a plot. So they didn't succeed to damage energy facilities in three states in the Southeast. You have the white supremacists in Idaho, October 2020, also a planning phase. And so it's thwarted before anything bad happens. And then May of 2020 in Las Vegas, that was a group known as Boogaloo. It's a right-wing group. All of them sort of start to sound the same, but they each have sort of different focuses. And so those are that's the drumbeat that we're seeing now, and those are important to note. I should say why 2020? Why all of a sudden 2020 is when in Telegram, which is a platform where not great stuff is often shared, a manifesto is issued by one of these organizations about critical infrastructure, that this will be their new target for a variety of reasons. Some of it is its vulnerability. And that is viewed by the FBI and DHS as a sort of, you know, call to the world to wreak havoc. DHS and FBI begin to release what we call intelligence bulletins out to the states and locals. They just updated that release the week before the weekend of the North Carolina attack, that of their concerns of right-wing focus on critical infrastructure. I don't know if any of these are related. It's sometimes hard to show the linkages. Sometimes the linkage is just ideology. It's just these guys find each other online and they work each other up into planning these attacks. So that's what we're seeing nationally. And that's just honestly, people, I'm not a fear monger. That's just one sector. And so when you think about, gosh, how do we do this? I mean, part of it is, what is your standards, right? In terms of what investments do you want to make just to make this stuff safer? And some of it's easy. It's lighting or sandbags or cement walls. Some of it may be more expensive, as we've seen, but this is the complicated world of dynamic systems and trying to secure them, because you cannot make them impenetrable. Transportation is a perfect example. You could not make a subway system safe. We don't talk in those terms, because if you did, you don't have the subway system, because everyone would have to be checked and it would take 4 hours to get from uptown to downtown. We accept levels of vulnerability so that we can be connected and have the kind of luxuries of living in a society where I've got a TV and a computer on and making some tea and all the stuff that I'm doing right now as I speak to you.
Right. Juliette Kayyem is a CNN national security analyst. John Wellinghoff is CEO and founder of Grid Policy Consulting. And you are listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Well, this listener writes, how can FERC or some agency enforce the rules to get PG&E or others to put up sandbags or whatever? I mean, John, you alluded to FERC's lack of authority to force a utility to adopt a given physical safety plan and so on. Do you think FERC needs more power to be able to do that, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission?
Well, first, Mina, we have to remember that these are private corporations largely that own this infrastructure. I mean, there is some federal infrastructure and infrastructure in the hands of the states, but most of it is ultimately in the hands of private corporations. So it's very difficult for FERC to actually, you know, force or order someone to specifically do something. As I mentioned, the current standards that the industry wrote themselves, that FERC adopted, simply require that industry, require the electric industry to determine what they want to protect and then tell FERC how they're going to protect it. That's basically the bottom line of what that standard says. So I think we do need to kind of step it up, but it's up to Congress. Congress would be the one who would have to ultimately put in place more stringent rules. It was interesting, your reporter Dan, I believe, talked about what the CPUC in California and the California legislature did. And what he recounted, it sounded to me like exactly what the federal government has done, and that's simply tell PG&E that they have to determine what they want to protect, and then they have to develop a plan that they submit to the California Public Utilities Commission. So that seems to me to be exactly parallel to what they're doing at the federal level, which is no surprise to me, because I'm sure there were utility lobbyists in the California legislature, just like there are in Congress, telling them, oh, no, this is, you know, the standard that FERC has, so let's just do it to that standard. So we need to think about, you know, potentially having this a little bit more prescriptive and having a little bit more authority in some agency, and whether it be FERC or whether it be DHS. DHS has no authority, I believe, and Juliet's the expert here, to order any private corporation to do anything. And that's troubling when these corporations have in their hands critical infrastructure that is, you know, things that we depend on in our lives every day.
That's right.
So, Juliet, that's true that DHS also wouldn't have the authority?
No. I mean, there's regulatory floors that are set. You know, we want you to do this. But there's not resources for enforcement. So what can drive better behavior? One is, as John said, better, stronger laws at Congress. If you're serious about this, these companies are private companies. They are serving a public good, but they are rich. I mean, a lot of them are they are benefiting from access to our delivering these resources. They're not doing this as a favor. So you can get them to commit. The second area where you're starting to see some changes, of course, the market itself. I mean, these companies, PG&E, doesn't like being known as it's known in California for its inability to withstand climate change. People will remember Duke for this. BP is another example. So part of it is their own corporate structure motivates investments in safety and security. And you're starting to see some changes to boards to begin to reflect safety and security. And then on the other side is there has been liability for these companies if you can show negligence or failure to gross negligence in these cases. So there are different tools, but none of them would be as good as can we get a system that we have confidence in that these companies simply know what they need to do, much like the airline industry knows its obligation for how it builds airplanes. The airline industry is not making airplanes without a lot of government oversight about how those things will fly and the safety features in them. And we can do the same with critical infrastructure.
Well, the listener writes, what about robotic security that companies like Knightscope are now contracting with power providers like PG&E? John, robotic security, tech is a solution here?
Well, unfortunately, the utilities have an incentive to make the solution as expensive as possible. Yeah. And the reason they do is because they get a return on their investment. And so the more money they spend, the more they get to make in profit. So what we need to do is ensure that they put in simple, low-cost solutions that are effective and not go to the most highest tech thing that they can then charge us the ratepayers for and make a profit off of.
Yeah. Well, this listener tweets, I keep hearing about white supremacists taking out power grids as a strategy to create chaos so they can take control. Is it known what their plan is to take control of the situation once they've created chaos? I guess, Juliet, is it as coordinated? We don't want to fearmonger, as you say on this show, right?
No.
And we don't know for sure who is behind this, but is it as coordinated?
No. I mean, it's not. Look, I mean, the idea of coordination, the idea of incitement is complicated in a world in which these guys are sort of feeding off each other. In a lot of the cases I mentioned earlier, a lot of these guys never met until they met online, and then they're just feeding off of each other. Sometimes they're bozos, sometimes they're not bozos. We simply don't know. I mean, January 6th, for example, is a combination of people who got swept in something that they now regret and people who were, for example, planning an insurrection. It could be a combination of motivations, and we simply don't know what their plan is once the lights go out. What people have to remember is a lot of this incitement, a lot of these people live in a world in which that they imagine that as being more likely than not, because their sense of America is so warped about how we might behave against each other.
Well, thank you, Juliet and John, and thank you, listeners. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, and the Heising-Simons Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.